From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
It's a story of hope, a story about love, and most of all, it's a story about ideas. Public Radio International and Wisconsin Public Radio proudly present To the Best of Our Knowledge, the movie.
Part 2, Revenge of the Ideas.
Starring Jim Fleming.
I don't think it's going to be what I expected it to be because the trailer last time misled me.
Steve Paulson.
Sometimes I feel when I'm watching a movie trailer that I'm watching the whole movie. I mean, I know everything is condensed into 2 minutes, but you get the beginning, you get the middle, mm-hmm. you practically see people dying. You feel you're seeing the whole thing.
And Anne Strangeamps.
You've taken the character of the monster and developed him considerably, to the point that the monster is the narrator.
I'm going to come and get you and kill you. Don't miss the movie that critics are calling the intellectual thrill ride of the year. To the Best of Our Knowledge, the movie.
Part 2, Revenge of the Ideas.
Because let's face it, baby, these days, you gotta have a sequel.
Coming soon to a theater near you.
Today we look at sequels and spin-offs. Seems the majority of movies now playing at the multiplex. Or sequels. Is this just a blatant attempt to take more of our money from films that had a good first run? Or can sequels be original, creative works of art? Also, we'll look at fan fiction as literature and meet the author of Frankenstein's Monster, a sequel to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. But first, Jonathan Gray. Gray is an associate professor of media and cultural studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also the author of Show Sold Separately, Promos, Spoilers, and Other Media Paratexts. Jonathan Gray explains what a media paratext is.
Paratexts are all those things that surround film and TV or anything else for that matter, a book, a video game, that aren't considered part of the thing itself, but that play a huge role in giving us a sense of what that thing means. So, I mean, just to give you a few examples is the best way to illustrate it. Things like trailers, the posters for a movie, if you hear podcasts or if there are DVD bonus materials, if there's a spin-off toy, if there's a spin-off video game, all those things, as I said, that sort of surround that you would sort of exclude and say, well, that's not the thing itself. But what I was interested in with the book is how those things actually play a key role in determining what the thing itself is.
So how does this differ from hype, from promos, or does that just sort of encompass all of the hype and the promotion and the marketing?
Yeah, the hype is very much part of it. Why I used the word paratext was because what I wanted to do is sort of focus on what they do in terms of meaning rather than what they do in terms of profit. So when we talk about hype, we're usually referring to, you know, the sort of money-generating aspect of it. And of course, that's why a lot of them exist. But I was also interested in, you know, for instance, when you see a poster for a movie several months before it comes out, how does that start the process of interpreting the movie? How does it start the process of getting us thinking about what is that movie? What are the characters? What kind of world is this set in? So how do we start to imagine the world and the narrative before we've even got there?
In fact, in the introduction to the book, you even said, and I'll quote to you, I think this is right, while many consumers deride the presence of hype and licensed merchandise as a nuisance, we also rely upon it, at least in part, to help us get through an evening's viewing or a trip to the multiplex. And I was thinking about that, and it's true that without that, you don't know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
And with it, sometimes you understand more than you would if you had to rely entirely on what the thing itself is going to give you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the other day I went and saw a movie, and as is the case, you know, there were something like 9 previews beforehand. And at the end of that, I had a sense of one of those 9 films being something I wanted to watch, one that I guess I could watch, and 7 that, you know, I'd rather you do horrible things to me than make me watch because it looked like they'd be a horrible thing. And so, you know, it was an important way of me making a decision. And for the one that I'm interested in, I now have a sense of sort of, you know, who are those characters? What kind of world we're living in? The world's already sort of started for me. There's a sort of nugget of a narrative and of something that I might engage with.
Sometimes it's more than a nugget too, isn't it? I mean, sometimes the trailer that you see for a movie is actually all you'd really want to see that movie.
The Onion News Network, the great satirist, they have a wonderful instance of this where they did a thing about playing with the idea that the Iron Man trailer was so good that I think it was Paramount Pictures had decided that they were going to make a full-length movie based on this trailer.
Apparently, the plan is to expand that fast montage of very short shots seen in the trailer into full-length distinct scenes. And in between those scenes, they plan to add additional scenes that weren't in the trailer.
Just doesn't seem like that would work.
That's right. The fact is, it's very difficult to make the character, story, action that work in a 90-second format also work when they're stretched out to 80 or 90 minutes.
Why do you think the trailer was so popular?
Well, it does tell an amazing story, Michael. A cocksure billionaire industrialist and inventor is kidnapped, but turns on his captors by designing an amazing mechanized suit of armor, ultimately becoming a hero to the world. It is a breathtaking 90-second thrill ride.
Surely then, Paramount realizes the tremendous financial risk of alienating the trailer's core fan base if they don't embrace the film properly.
Exactly,
and
that's why the studio has tried to reassure the public that everything that they love about the trailer will be incorporated into the movie adaptation, right down to actual lines from the trailer. And they are bringing Robert Downey Jr. back to reprise his role as Tony Stark.
Well, there would have been a real outcry if they had tried to cast someone else.
Yes.
What they were playing with was the fact that it was a brilliant trailer. Many people watched it. It looked great. But the question was, could the movie actually live up to this trailer? And we've probably all seen these examples with comedies, right, where they're super funny. And yet you go and watch the movie and the only funny lines in the movie were in the trailer.
Yeah, that's actually sort of disturbing when it happens to you. And I don't know entirely whether it's because you already knew all of those jokes. Mm-hmm. If you hadn't had them beforehand, would they have been funnier as they came up in context?
Well, and also you end up wondering whether you were duped. There was a really interesting article in the New Yorker a while back where they did a profile of a guy who works for Lionsgate Entertainment hyping all of their films. And they gave the example of when he was hyping W, the Oliver Stone film. It was marketed very much as a sort of Michael Moore kind of irreverent, we're going to really attack George W. Bush. But in fact, if anyone saw the movie, it depicts Bush as kind of a tragic figure. And so people who saw the hype would have expected something very different. But part of what this profile was looking at was how this guy said, there are two separate things. One is what happens when you're in the cinema. One is how I get you to the cinema. And I stand by my choices, even if they have nothing to do with the film. That's it's going to get you there.
Well, and of course, that's what he's trying to accomplish, except for the eventual payoff, which may hurt him. If you watch too many of these things, the next time you'll say, well, that's another Oliver Stone film. I don't think it's going to be what I expected it to be because the trailer last time misled me.
Yeah, no, I mean, this can start to kick back on itself. And I mean, trailer rhetoric is so common that it's very easy to parody it, as with the example I told you of The Onion. I also think if there's a popular video you could look up on YouTube, I think it's the trailer for every movie. And it's just a sort of trailer for the quintessential Oscar-winning movie, and it introduces all the characters. It has the set pieces of music.
A naive yet inspiring statement. And the music gets hopeful.
Specific outlining of your major character flaws. Overreaction.
Friendly black optimistic advice.
Passionately! Whispered repetition.
This scene doesn't make it to the final cut of the movie.
Inspiring final lines of a speech that douchebags will quote in their Facebook profiles!
There really are only a few pieces of music that we hear in trailers, like Salisbury Hill or the Requiem for a Dream song that became most famous when it was used in the trailer for The Lord of the Rings and then gets used in pretty much every action movie since then. They use the same techniques over and over again.
Uh, I was actually thinking about it, especially with Lord of the Rings. The whole DVD extra thing was integrated from the beginning of the filmmaking process. But it made me wonder whether the books have now become paratext for the movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's all relative.
I wonder what Tolkien would think of that.
Exactly. He's been relegated for some people. As I said, it's relative to who the individual is. I don't doubt that there are some people out there who grown up, I'd include myself in this group, grown up being Lord of the Rings fans of the books, and the films will only ever be a sort of part of the books. But for many other people out there, the books are just sort of reduced to a footnote now, and it's the movies that come first and foremost.
I remember having a surprising discussion with my son, who's in his 30s now, and he has never read the books.
Oh.
But he loves the movies.
Sacrilege.
I agree completely, but there you are.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's interesting, too, is even if you know that the book came first, we don't always experience it that way. I remember the first time I read Mario Puzo's Godfather, and I was fascinated because it gave me a whole new line on a bunch of the characters from the film, and I knew that the novel had come first, but I didn't experience it first.
One of the other things that you talk about is the new business of alternate reality games, of video games, which are a different kind of paratext.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's gone on there is you get a bunch of producers who grew up with Star Wars toys and with all these other things and realize how important they were. And so now when they're writing their stories, they realize, wait, why do I just have to write the story in the film? Or why do I just have to write a TV show? I want to do the spin-off comic. I want to have a hand in making the video game. I want to create this world that flows between different media. And so, as you said, with several of these shows, you can go online and you find, you know, web pages that are in-world. So, you know, for Lost, there was this mysterious fictional organization called the Hanso Foundation, and you could go to the Hanso Foundation's website. And so you get this sort of experience of stepping into the world, and the writers are sort of having fun with this, telling a story across different venues.
I would imagine there'd be some problems with that, though, the temptation to leave part of the story out so that you can tell it in a different venue could end up harming the essence of the story, which was to have begun all of this.
This is often called transmedia. For those people who create transmedia, it's a really hard issue. You can think of the Matrix films as an example. You know, the Matrix 1 was very successful, and then the Wachowski brothers, who wrote the Matrix, in writing number 2 and number 3, got this idea that they'd like to thread it through the video game and through other properties that surround it. The problem was they put information into the video game that would have helped the movie. And they had a little too much trust and faith that the audience wanted to experience all of those things. Some people just wanted to go and watch a movie, and they didn't feel that they had to do homework before the movie, and they weren't into games, and they didn't want to go there. And so it's a real challenge. You know, if you do want to tell a story over multiple media, how do you do it in a way that makes it important for those people who do go to those other venues, but doesn't make it so important that those who don't feel like they're missing out on something.
So where do you see it going now? Where is paratext headed?
I don't know. I think we're going to continue to see people trying to experiment with this. I think where it'll work is in places where it has worked, like Lord of the Rings or Star Wars, these large universes where it's quite okay to cut off one segment of it, and we don't need to know about every segment of it as a reader or as a viewer to engage with another segment. If you imagine a narrative as a line, there's always going to be a problem with that model. If you need to get one piece of information before you can move to the next space on the line, that's going to be a no-win situation for storytelling. Whereas if storytelling is a three-dimensional model and you can go in a variety of different directions, then there's perhaps a little more scope for all of these other things to be part of the storytelling process.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of when the web began to first take on the aspect that we've all become familiar with. Mm. And it was filled with hypertext links that would take you away from the story that you were in. Often you never ended up back on the page where you started.
Yeah, it's the danger that we're always moving to the next and never finishing where we began.
Right. At least with paratext in the way that you've been describing it, there is an original body of work about which all of the rest of this is built.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the pluses, I guess, of there being a profit incentive behind a lot of it is that because ultimately the people who are creating this want you to get back to what they often call the mothership, because that's where they make most of their money, they'll try to create it in a way that brings you back to that sort of central point. If there was less of that, we might be sort of lost in the wilderness with each of us reading a very different part. It sort of would be like the experience of ripping a novel into its many pages and giving each reader one page, and no one could be on the same page, quite literally.
Jonathan Gray is the author of Show, Sold Separately, Promos, Spoilers, and Other Media Paratexts. What do you think about media paratexts? How they change the way you experience movies and TV shows? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, we'll explore sequel mania, Hollywood's love affair with a sequel, as we continue our hour on sequels and spinoffs. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin System eCampus, providing access to online degree programs and certificates offered by the 26 campuses of the UW system. Information is at ecampus.wisconsin.edu.
Movie ads used to say, "You've read the book, now see the movie." These days, the ads are more likely to say, "You've seen the original, now see the sequel." And the sequel to the sequel. Well, there's no escaping Hollywood's love affair with extending stories across multiple films. As Constantine Varavis knows all too well, Varavis is senior lecturer in film and television studies at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. He's also the co-editor, along with Carolyn Jess Cook, of Second Takes, Critical Approaches to the Film Sequel. Varavis told Steve Paulson why so many movie sequels are being made.
Some would say that it's a purely commercial imperative, that if you have a property that has been successful, an original film that has made money, that has created an audience for itself, that one of the ways in which to guarantee another part of the market share is to extend and further develop that property through those various strategies that I've described, either remaking sequels or series. We can think about it, I suppose, related to genre filmmaking, where people want to go and see something which is new, but also something that is familiar. So remakes and sequels and series are, in a sense, more specific instances of the kind of strategies that we find in genre filmmaking, where there is a sense that we have a pre-sold audience, an audience that already takes an interest in a thriller or a horror film or a Western, that will go back and look for more of the same in a similar way and more precise way, I suppose. The remake or the sequel wants to attract that pre-sold audience. So certainly that's the commercial explanation for the phenomenon of sequels and sequelization.
Well, most film critics don't like sequels and remakes because they seem to lack originality, which is often the gold standard for what people look for in a movie. Do you share this critique of the lack of originality in a sequel?
No, I don't. I suppose what I've tried to do and what we've tried to do in the Second Takes book is to open up the concept of the remake and the sequel. I think one way to think about of these is to, say, take the instance of the remake. If we think about it as a noun, we can think of film remakes as a group of films that are derived in some way or another from previously made films. And there's a sense that they get, duplicated and repeated. But if we think about the idea of remakes as a verb, if we think that the film remakes, then we can think about it in the way that it transforms in a continual process of production. So it becomes a more creative and open-ended thing. And another way of thinking about that, I suppose, is that there's a very specific thing, which is the film remake, this category of films derived from other properties. But there's also the concept of film remaking, and this is an endless process of production that we find in all filmmaking. And I guess we tried to take that similar idea to the concept of the sequel, to think about the film sequel as a noun, as a quite specific thing, but also to think about the process of sequelization and to open that up beyond simply industrial or commercial ideas.
And then usually when people talk about how the sequel took over Hollywood, they talk about the 1970s to the big blockbusters.
Yes.
And I suppose Star Wars is the obvious example because it spawned these incredibly successful sequels.
That's right. There is a sense that through the 1970s that Hollywood starts to increase its number of remakes and sequels. I haven't done the number crunching myself, but others have. It doesn't seem to be the case when you look at the figures that there is any greater number of sequels or remakes being made through that period. But certainly we have these very high-profile blockbuster films, as you say, from Star Wars, from slightly earlier with Jaws, from 1975. And of course, before that, one of the best known sequels in The Godfather Part 2.
Let me ask you about the Godfather movies, because that's a fascinating case, because Godfather Part 2 was the first sequel ever to win an Academy Award for Best Film. And what's striking about that second Godfather movie is, I mean, part of it takes place actually before the first Godfather movie. And that's what, I suppose, that's partly what gives it this sense of originality, that it wasn't just picking up on where things were left after the first movie.
Yes, it has that interesting structure and that kind of awkward term, the prequel, that is used to describe those films. Quite often in the case where there seems to be no way to develop the story beyond the previous installment, usually because of the death of a principal character, and so we go back to an earlier moment in that in time. So The Godfather does pick up that structure where it's a bit of a prequel and also a sequel, and sets up the parallel stories of Michael Corleone taking over the empire after his father's death, and also the pre-story of Vito and how he's actually built the family up to the point of the events of the previous film.
There's a plane waiting for us to take us to Miami in an hour, all right? They'll make a big thing about it. I know it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart. You broke my heart.
You have an essay in your book, Second Takes, called Redefining the Sequel, and you focus on George Romero's trilogy of zombie films. If people don't remember, Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Day of the Dead. And then later on, he did a fourth and a fifth zombie movie as well.
And a sixth one now.
Oh, a sixth one, too.
There's a sixth one as well.
I guess you like zombie films.
I do. It seemed to be an interesting case study for the reasons I addressed before, taking up this idea of sequelization and trying to open it up, to try to understand how that concept is kept in place.
So how did George Romero approach this whole notion of sequels?
He wanted to allegorize by way of the zombie film and to depict kind of an idea of class struggle, of this underclass of zombies trying to reassert themselves. And so Romero says that he saw the zombie film through the 70s, 80s, into the 90s as an opportunity to create a kind of a snapshot of what America was like at the time that he was making the particular installment.
So there's a political dimension to George Romero's zombie films. I guess I never realized that.
Well, it seems to be one of the things that audiences are attracted to. I guess as the films progress in the series, the political message becomes increasingly overt. I suppose as it is in the case of Land of the Dead, where America seems to have become a walled fortress, trying to insulate itself from the outside world. And one of the characters is thought to be a George Bush Jr. type character. Dawn of the Dead does this particularly well by having the survivors take refuge in a shopping mall, and this becomes sort of a comment on consumer America in the 1970s, with the zombies kind of like dazed shoppers trying to return to the mall to find their former identities through shopping and consumerism.
They're still here.
They're after us. They know we're still in here.
They're after the place. They don't know why. They just remember. Remember that they want to be in here.
What the hell are they?
They're us, that's all. There's no more room in hell.
What?
Something my granddaddy used to tell us. You know Mukumba? Voodoo. Granddad was a priest in Trinidad. He used to tell us, when there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth.
Constantine Varavis is the co-editor of and a contributor to Second Takes, Critical Approaches to the Film Sequel. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Do you have a favorite movie sequel? One that you like even more than the original? We'd love to know what it is. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, a sequel to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And a literary look at fan fiction as we conclude our hour on sequels and spin-offs. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Susan Habor O'Keefe is the author of many acclaimed children's books, including One Hungry Monster and Hungry Monster ABC. So it's only fitting that her debut adult novel is called Frankenstein's Monster. It is a sequel to Mary Shelley's 1818 novel Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus. Habor O'Keefe told Anne Strandchamps what inspired her to write a sequel to Shelley's classic novel.
I love the book. I love the character. The fact that he's portrayed and understood so differently from how he's portrayed in the book. And then, of course, the most natural thing is that you don't know at the end what happens to him. There's no conclusion. In many other books, say Dracula, for example, Dracula is staked and dead. So unless there's some sort of, you know, resurrection or something like that, or it's another type of vampire book, you know, there's no possibility for a sequel, you know, staying true to the original.
You know, I confess I actually had forgotten what happened to Frankenstein's monster at the end of the book. You know, I remembered the classic moment, it's alive, but I couldn't actually remember how the story ends. How does it end?
And that classic moment is only from the movie, it's not from the book.
Huh. What happens to Frankenstein's monster in the book?
At the very end, Victor Frankenstein and the monster are chasing each other, or actually the monster keeps leading him on. Frankenstein has vowed to kill him because the monster has killed his family. So they're going through the Arctic, and then Victor Frankenstein is just worn out and exhausted, and he's picked up by ship captain Robert Walton. And Walton is the frame story through his ship's log and different letters that he addresses to his sister Margaret. And he repeats the story that Frankenstein tells to him about the creation of the monster. And of course, he does not take it seriously. And then Frankenstein dies, and Walton feels a great deal of grief because he felt like he never really had a true friend. And here he has a friend who's then taken from him so quickly. And very, very shortly after his death, he hears a noise. He goes to the cabin, and he sees this creature standing over Frankenstein's body. And he's just smacked in the face with reality that this is indeed true, the story that he heard. And, you know, there's an exchange between them. And the monster says he's just in such intense pain over his existence that he says he's going to leave and go to the North Pole and immolate himself. And then the very, very last lines of the book, which I just love them. He sprang from the cabin window as he said this, upon the ice raft which lay close to the vessel. He was soon borne away by the waves and lost in darkness and distance. And that's the end of Shelley's book.
Boy, it really does leave you hanging, doesn't it?
Yes.
It kind of begs for a conclusion.
Definitely. I mean, there's so many possibilities of what could happen after that.
Well, so let's begin your story where you pick it up. The beginning of your story begins with a journal.
It continues Walton's reaction. And the very next sentence after that from Walton is, "Can a man change so quickly? We are promised that by grace salvation can come in an instant. They already know that condemnation can be a swift. Suddenly there was something at work in my soul that I did not understand." So just the sight of the monster has totally upended all his beliefs about the entire world and ultimately about himself.
Now, you've taken the character of the monster and developed him considerably to the point that most of the book is the monster is the narrator.
Mm-hmm.
Could you read just a bit from the first, it's a journal that the monster has been keeping. Could you read the very first entry we hear in his voice?
Okay. Rome, April 15th, 1838. I killed my father again last night. It was the same dream as always, my father and myself, pursuing and pursued, till I no longer knew who he was, who I was, indeed if there were any difference between us. In the dream, my father chases me over a stretch of the Arctic, as he did in the weeks before his death. Once more I flee from his wrath, and at the same time lure him on. I drive the sled dogs wildly. As the dogs pant, their spittle freezes and is swept backward by the wind to hail needles against my face. Fog rises from the ice and clings thickly to the dogs. I am pulled along by white devils from hell. Devil, was that not his very first word upon seeing me rise up? What had he wanted from his labors that I proved so poor a substitute? In the dream, as in life, he chases me endlessly. As it cracks wide, the ice beneath us roars like a wounded behemoth. Huge white blocks are shoved upward in nightmare architecture. At last I abandon the sled and cross the broken ice on foot. Greater and greater are the blocks I must climb, the gaps I must leap. Black water laps at the edges of ice. My father is nearby. I hear him mutter fiend and abomination. His face appears, framed by white mist. It mirrors my own horror and hatred. I reach out. My fingers curl around his throat as his reach out to mine. He laughs. I wonder if my face shows the same delight. That is all I remember before waking. I know that I have killed him. I do not know if he has killed me. It has taken me these 10 years to be able to recognize that Victor Frankenstein was my father. If he had lived, might he have learned to call me his son?
Wow, that's such a dramatic beginning to the book. And the monster, he needs a name. He winds up being called Victor himself. He takes his father's name. But the monster just jumps off the page. I mean, his character, his personality, and for one thing, his literacy. In your imagination, he has learned to read and write and think.
Again, this is part of the extraordinary misunderstanding because people only have the image of Boris Karloff's monster from the movies. In the original, he is inarticulate when he first arises or is given life, and he goes out to the countryside, you know, survives as best as he can, and then eventually moves into a little hut next to a small family way out in the country. And, you know, of course, this too is also extraordinary, and it has been subject to some criticism over the years. By listening to the people there, he learns to speak, to read, and to write. And within a couple of years, the first three books that he reads are Paradise Lost, Plutarch's Lives, and The Sorrows of Young Werther. So it is not at all this leap that I myself have done. It's just really building on what was already there.
Oh. There are parts when reading your book is almost painful. This poor monster who comes across as such an intelligent, thoughtful, humane, kind person who is treated abominably by just about every human being in the book.
Yes, but despite all of his kindness and thoughtfulness, there is a good deal of him that is a monster and always has been, and that's part of his struggle, because he really does do some monstrous things in the book until actually very close to the end.
I guess one of the big questions he keeps grappling with is, what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be human? What do you think? Is he human?
I think at the end, obviously he's human in terms of he's made from human parts. I think that he finds his humanity toward the end, or a glimpse that he can be human, and that part of it is a choice in terms of he really has to make an effort not to do the kinds of things that are monstrous, you know, acting on rage. And in his own way, he sees people as objects the way they see him. And he has to, I think at the end, he feels some empathy for people. And I think that's where the growth toward humanity starts, when he begins to feel other people's pain. He knows he hurts, but I think when he feels other people's pain, then there's a glimpse of possibility. I'm not sure if he's fully human by the end, you know, in terms of what we might think of as, you know, his soul or spirit being fully human. But there's the possibility that he realizes there is the possibility even for him.
Well, at the end of your book, you do kind of leave us hanging a bit. There's certainly room for another sequel. Do you have any plans to write a sequel to Frankenstein's Monster?
I'm not sure. I know what happens next. You know, in my mind, it's, I don't want to say a trilogy, but it's sort of three separate parts of his life, and this book is part one. And I think it's only because it's natural that authors know what happens to their characters. You know, they pick an end because of the resolution of whatever the current problems and crisis and plot that they build the book around. But short of a character dying at the end, the character lives on. And I think all authors have sequels in them, even if they never see actual paper or actually published.
Susan Habor O'Keefe is the author of Frankenstein's Monster, a novel. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. If you're reading a story in which Jane Austen's classic character Elizabeth Bennet sits at her computer, or a story called Green Eggs and Hamlet, in which Hamlet talks to his father's ghost in Sousspeak, you're reading fan fiction, or fanfic. Fan fiction authors use their own imaginations to take existing characters from literature, movies, TV, and even real life into alternative scenarios and literary universes. Sheena Pugh's the author of The Democratic Genre, Fan Fiction in a Literary Context. The history of fan fiction goes back a long way, as Pugh told Anne Strainchamps.
Basically, as far as mythology, as soon as you have a canon of stories, which is all that a mythology is, then you have people who invent their own take on them. For instance, way, way back in the days of ancient Greece, you have this poet called Stesichoros, who invents a story in which Helen of Sparta never goes to Troy. In fact, she goes to Egypt, and the gods send a kind of phantasm of her to Troy in order to start the war. And it's pretty much a kind of alternative universe take on it. It's very like quite a lot of scientific fan fiction nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Are there plays or stories, books that we now consider classics of the, you know, the Western literary canon, which in fact you could call fan fiction?
Oh, absolutely. The one most people would be able to quote you offhand is White Sargasso Sea, which is Jean Rhys's piece of fan fiction on Jane Eyre from a different viewpoint, that of Rochester's wife. Another obvious one is George MacDonald Fraser's Flashman books, which took one minor character from Tom Brown's school days and spun 12 novels off him.
Uh-huh. Well, so contrast that with the view of some of the contemporary writers who are adamantly opposed to fan fiction. Anne Rice, for instance.
Who knows why Anne Rice says anything? She's very, very proprietary about her characters, yes. I own these characters, you must not do anything with them. There have always been authors who felt that way, I think. But in sober truth, once you invent a character and put them in print, they're out there in the world. And anyone else can interpret them what way they like. What they can't do, of course, is pass their work off as yours or make money out of it. Because, you know, insofar as copyright exists, it's for that, so that people cannot take what you've created and make money out of it, which is rightly your money. But fan fiction isn't done for money, it's done for love. It's just, what else might have happened to these characters? What else would I like to happen to these characters?
I know there are authors who try to actively discourage fan fiction, but I mean, really, what can they do to prevent it?
Absolutely nothing. Unless it's done for money, or possibly, unless it brings them somehow into disrepute. I think J.K. Rowling may have gone after some Harry Potter adult fan fiction because, understandably, she doesn't want it out there where children might see it. But in the main, she's actually very keen on fan fiction. She said she saw it as a great compliment when she realised it was up there. And I've met many authors who feel the same about it.
Hmm. And yet, I do have some sympathy, don't you, for the author who may feel extremely invested in their characters and feel that they see absolutely how the characters' lives go. And then, you know, how horrifying to have some reader come along and make up a completely different story. You know, have your main lead wind up with a different boy or girl.
Well, they have to grow up, don't they, and recognize that that's what happens. I don't think any author necessarily knows his or her characters as well as they think they do. There's actually a lovely short story by Rudyard Kipling called The Last of the Stories, in which he imagines himself going down to hell and meeting all the characters from his stories. And they all basically tell him he got them wrong, that he never really understood them. I think it's well possible for authors to get their characters wrong once in a while, even the best. Let's think about Jane Austen. They don't come any better, do they? Well, when Darcy is proposing to Elizabeth for the second time, when she's accepted him, he calls her dearest, loveliest Elizabeth. And I can't read this without cringing. I just know he didn't say it.
Mr.
It's not
Darcy.
His voice. Now, you know, I can think that, and she obviously didn't, but I think personally she would have had the wits to think, well, okay, that's somebody else's take on him. In point of fact, Jane kind of wrote fan fiction herself for her own characters, in that people would write to her asking what happened to Kitty or who did Mary Bennet marry, and she would quite cheerfully supply them answers.
Mm-hmm. That's funny, thinking about Mr. Yeah. Darcy. You're quite right. I never thought about that phrase, but Mr. Darcy would never have been that sappy.
No, I don't think he would. I think that phrase is wrong. And it just proves that the fact that you're the author doesn't mean you know these characters back to front, because you don't. They can always surprise you.
Now, Jane Austen is a perfect case in point, because I think generations of women readers have sighed over Mr. Darcy, including me, the first time I read Pride and Prejudice as a teenager. And you put down the book and you want more. You think, wait, what did he say to her after that?
Yeah.
Is that
why
people write fan fiction, simply because they don't want the book to end?
Very often, yes. Certainly, the better the author, the more likely that is to be the reason, I think. People just want to know what happened afterwards. How did Darcy manage to get along with Elizabeth's family? Who did so-and-so marry? That kind of thing is only natural. The other possibility is, where were people when they weren't in the book? Where was Heathcliff when he was away for 4 years and we never saw him? You know, it's only natural. You can remember yourself when you were a child, maybe, and a book came to an end, or a TV series or a film, And you just didn't want it to stop. You wanted to go on. And so you made it go on in your head. That's what we all did until the blessed internet came along and we found that everyone was doing it.
Another motivation, I would think, would be you don't just want more, you want more from a book. So, for instance, Jane Austen wrote this wonderful romance at an age when one didn't really divulge very many details, romantically speaking. Well, we have different standards now. We fleshed out love scenes. We want more back and forth between the man and the woman. Is that another reason people write fan fiction?
Yes. I think it's more commonly a reason that's connected with TV fan fiction. They want more from it in the sense that they want things that weren't done in the TV series. And very often what they want is emotional interaction that didn't come into the TV series because it wasn't exciting enough. The TV series wanted people rushing about zapping things. And quite often the fans of, say, 70s cop dramas or space dramas, many of them were women and, you know, they liked what was going on, but they could think of all sorts of other things that could have been going on as well and weren't. And that was what they were writing. They were writing all the emotional backstory that the original writers didn't put in. Mm. You do get that with Jane Austen too, but I don't think it succeeds particularly well because normally when she leaves something out, there's a good reason for leaving it out. In a book, you're not constrained to a half-hour slot. You can put in what you like. What Jane doesn't do, of course, ever, is put in a scene with only men in it, because she's always somewhere in a woman's point of view. And some of the more successful Austen fanfic does actually go from the point of view of men.
Huh, for example?
Now. There's a very funny one called At the Club by a woman called Elspeth, where she imagines a bunch of Austen heroes dropping in at the gentleman's club of an evening and more or less pouring out their woes in the same way that a group of women might do. And it's really quite funny because it's so unexpected.
In your book, you describe several different categories of fan fiction. Yeah. There's angst, alternate universe. What are some of the main categories of fan fiction?
Well, for a start, you have the three categories that go by sexual content. Gen, which means no sexual content or very little. Het, which is heterosexual. And slash, which is homosexual. Then again, you have genres which are based on the kind of story it is. Alternate universe is something like setting Pride and Prejudice in the 21st century. You get what I think is now called mashes, but in fact used to be called crossovers, where two fanfic universes collide. Mm-hmm. Angst and Hurt Comfort were two quite early ones which focused on emotional backstory and general sort of ratcheting up the emotion in stories that didn't have that much.
Yeah, I was struck by the title of one of your chapters, A Good Reader Also Creates. I'm wondering what you meant by that, because it sort of suggests to me that you imagine a world in which high school or college English students are assigned to write fan fiction, kind of as a natural part of learning to read well and deeply.
Well, of course they do nowadays. They get a lot of assignments like that. A Good Reader Also Creates was something that a fan fiction writer called Bellatrix Carter quoted to me. I think she said it was a proverb, but I've never actually found it. Of course, you know, this happens everywhere. You read a piece of writing, you partly make the characters, don't you? You imagine them in your head. You perhaps make an appearance for them if their appearance isn't described. You know, you may maybe have them speak in an accent that the author didn't intend. You also, when the thing has come to an end, you go on. The mark of a good character, I think, is that he or she can exist outside the fiction. When the reader comes to an end, she doesn't think, oh, right, he's dead. She thinks, what does he do next? And that's where the reader comes in. Ever since, Death of the Author, Roland Barthes, I think most people now accept that readers can be co-creators to a degree. It's not all the author. It's not just, I know what happened and nobody else does.
You're, as you mentioned, you're a writer yourself. You're an award-winning poet. And you've written about fan fiction in poetry also, including there's one poem you wrote, Mary Sue's.
Oh, yeah. A Mary Sue is a version of the author who is inserted into the fanfiction universe. The most infamous one, you might say, was Wesley Crusher in the Star Trek universe, who was widely thought to have been the personal Mary Sue of Gene Roddenberry, whose middle name was Wesley, incidentally.
Why are they called Mary Sues?
Because, long time back, somebody wrote a satirical story about this kind of character in which she called her a Mary Sue. It's the same kind of character, if you like, that George Eliot was fulminating against when she wrote silly novels by lady novelists. It's an unduly perfect character who sails into the universe, puts everything right, marries a hero, dies a noble, self-sacrificing death, and that's her out of the picture. But it's what the author would have liked to be.
Do you have your poem with you?
Yes, I do.
Would you mind reading us your Mary Sue poem?
Sure. It was part of a sequence, in fact, which was called Fanfic. Mary Sue. I'm going in. I'm armed with a mind as lethal as a thermal lance. I hug the gun close to my side, my dance partner. I'm dangerous, but worth it. When I've zapped his captors, wiped the virus from his computer, when the guards are down, I can be gentle, if gentle's what he wants. He only needs to look past my perfect face, my body laser beam straight, taut with youth, and I'll be there. And what if every mirror, every calendar and CV, every pair of scales in the world says different? If all I have is the gift to see myself as others don't see me, in a shape, a world that never was, and write it down. It works, my teleport. I'm going in.
Sheena Pugh reading a poem about Mary Sue's from the fanfic sequence in her collection The Beautiful Lie. Pugh's the author of the democratic genre, fanfiction in a literary context. She spoke with Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 12A, Sequels and Spinoffs. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strangechamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Special thanks to special guest engineer Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.